video live?
It's video live, Tony. That's it.
Oh, all right.
but don't worry. The main thing is, let's not say anything that could get anybody into trouble. We should be okay. Okay, welcome everybody to Founders Focus. This is a special show because we usually do these shows on Wednesdays, but I wanted to make a special exception in this case because I wanted to accommodate this particular situation, because my guest today is the famous Tony Jamus, the hardest, the most elusive CEO to track down for a podcast, I think. So we had to move it to a Friday, and it's going to be a super exciting conversation with the leader of a business, I think, is that has, you know, one of the chances to win a very, very big prize in the world of work tech. So, Tony Jamus, CEO of Oyster, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Hong. Thank you for having me here. Excited to be talking to you all today.
The reason why I'm quite surprised that sort of Gab was able to kind of secure this conversation, Tony, is that I anticipated you'd be way too busy like doing like important CEO things. So I wondered, like, what did you have to cancel today in order to come on to Founders Focus?
Well, actually nothing, because we have at Oyster, we have something we call Focus Friday, where we don't have meetings on Fridays. It's really about catching up on the week and making sure we, at least for me, going into the weekend was clear agenda. Good morning, Elephant from New Mexico. Welcome to the show. And also, the secondly is because part of my job as a CEO is to be evangelizing about the company, about Oyster, about the future of work. I do have goals of a number of podcast months that I need to be on. So I'm very, very happy that we were able to finally connect and talk a bit.
That is amazing. You know, you've introduced already a really interesting innovation, this idea of a Focus Friday, which as a CEO, I guess you're responsible for. Like, when did this happen at Oyster? Was there a moment where you realized, actually, we can get too many meetings and it's actually counterproductive to get my team kind of just involved in all of this busy work? Was there a moment in your time at Oyster, or did you bring this in from Nexmo, like previous work?
No, actually, at Nexmo, I burned out as a CEO and an entrepreneur. I really couldn't balance this personal life with work, because work was so much consuming. And at Oyster, one of the commitment I have for myself is I don't want to burn out, and I want my team not to burn out as well, because I look at the CEO and see how the CEO is leading and living, and then they. So I don't want to put unnecessary pressure on my team. I don't want them to burn out. I deeply care about their well-being. So since the beginning of Oyster, my Friday was a no-meeting Friday. Wow. I was the only one doing that because I want to be present in the weekend for my children and my family and myself. So I take Friday as an opportunity to clean my inbox, take care of any project that might create anxiety for me during the weekend. So and then when our chief workplace officer Mark joined us, he was the ex-CPO at Envision and Lambda School, we've discussed about it, and we decided that let's make it a company policy. Let's make everybody in the company have a Focus Friday, and this is the day where we no internal meetings. It's 100% asynchronous work.
You know what? That's amazing, Tony. I think one of the things that CEOs often forget is that people do actually look up to the CEO. And they do actually, like, even if you're not consciously trying to do it, of course you're going to see the example. And of course you're going to try and do what the CEO does. So even if you're broadcasting, hey, listen, guys, no meetings on Fridays, but you're the one doing meetings, or you're the one doing whatever, everyone's going to still feel, you know what, Tony's doing that, I better do it. So I think this is like a really important insight for leading, yeah, not only rhetorically, but in reality.
One of the areas that was what we forget about leaders is that we have a responsibility to do no harm. We have to take our holidays so our team member can take our holidays. We have to work reasonable hours so our team can work reasonable hours. Like, you don't want to hurt anybody, right? You're here to create value, to improve the world, to give people the opportunity to succeed. But that's your job as a leader, and you have to look at yourself first and model the way. Otherwise, you may end up causing some harm somewhere in the world.
You know what? That's an amazing sort of insight also, Tony, because now that we're talking about it, it's obvious that the leader behavior is like the baseline. And I recall back in the day when you were office working and stuff like this, like you'd never want to leave before the boss, that kind of feeling, right?
Yeah.
And so the boss has to leave at 5:30 or whatever. You need to go because the like, other people worried about this.
Hong, it's really about psychological safety at work. Like, when I look around me, I see organization that engender fear with their workforce, with their employee base. Like it's sometimes it's people get afraid to fail, get afraid how they look internally. There's so much fear that dominates our workforce, and that shouldn't be the way. Like, how can we create a work situation where people can be themselves? They have a clear clarity in terms of what their goal, what their objective is. They know what good look like. They get regular feedback. This is what we're trying to create here at Oyster, is this kind of highly safe psychological environment, so people can feel good at the end of the day and about their work. And one way for me to measure that, to measure psychological safety, is how much fun we're having. Because you cannot combine these two. If people are afraid, they cannot have fun.
Correct.
Yeah. So fun for me is a leading indicator of psychological safety.
Yeah, but how do you measure it, Tony? How can you put a metric on the quantity of fun that is being had? I want to explore this because I think it might be possible, actually. Especially with the emoticons, sentiment analysis on chat and stuff, there's probably a way, right? So what have you thought about? Have you sort of thought about ways in which you might be able to measure this?
It's really hard to measure it. It's something you feel, right? However, what we've done at Oyster is we have every day within Teams, there is a chatbot in Slack that asks us, how are you feeling today? And you can put some words, there's emoticons that tells you if you're green, orange, or yellow. And that data is collected, and we have a dashboard that we can look at to look at, you know, how this well-being of the team has evolved over time and who is having more challenges than others. But in order for this to work, it has to be authentic. And that's why the leaders you cannot be green every day, right? So life is hard, life is challenging. The job of a leader is hard and lonely sometimes, and you need to be okay with being seen as vulnerable. Otherwise, you miss out on these signals from your organization. Because if the CEO is green, I have to be green, right?
Right.
And no, I mean, the CEO, I tend to kind of nuance a bit to provide an authentic view of what's happening within myself.
This is actually a really interesting ethical challenge, Tony. I hope you don't mind me just diving into this one a little bit more, because there is a difference between kind of self-reported data and revealed data, right? So as you say, people, if you want to give a report, inevitably you polish the report in some way because you want to present the best case. You don't want your boss to be upset. You do all of these things. And the boss is like, actually, just tell me what's really going on, because I really want to know. That's important for me in order for me to do my job, which is to make the best decision for the business. So what are your thoughts on this idea of, is there a way where we could ambiently monitor the feeling of the staff, for instance, without necessarily like presenting them with the question and answer interface? So for instance, we're seeing a lot of technology doing like organizational network analysis. I don't know if you heard of this term, but you know, tracking email frequency, for instance, or message frequency, looking at sentiment analysis in those messages. Does that then correlate with the number of sick days this person takes or whatever? And eventually you might be able to map out something like, oh, actually we've got this information. But then we have this like ethical challenge. Like, are we now intruding into what may be private comms and stuff like this? So do you have any opinions or thoughts on this, Tony?
Yeah, it has to. I mean, these are like, you can gain amazing insights from this approach, as long as they are compliant with privacy, and you respect the privacy and you protect the privacy of employees. Like, for instance, one thing we use at Oyster is we track the overall volume of traffic of Slack messages between the week and the weekend. And we want to drive the weekend down as much as possible, right? So that we're not infringing on we're not looking at the data. It's Slack surges kind of analytics, high level analytics for us, and from a platform usage standpoint. So there are ways to gain all these amazing insight without while keeping 100% protection of the privacy of the employee.
Yeah, very interesting. Tony, we've spent 10 minutes talking already, and the only thing we've talked about so far is like organizational culture. Can I just ask you the question directly? Like, why is this like super important to you? You mentioned earlier you had a tough sort of a end of time experience at Nexmo. So when you started Oyster, did you think, okay, we need to do it differently this time?
Definitely. So when I left my previous company, Nexmo, that was a public company, I got acquired last year by Ericsson for $6.5 billion. I took some time off, and it was an opportunity for me to align what I want to do next with what I believe in, how I want the world to look like in the future. And what was more important for me than what this company would do is why it exists. And it had to be a mission-driven company. At Nexmo, we were a global API company. We hired people in 45 countries, and I was able to witness the power of hiring people from anywhere. You can be the best employer in Argentina, for instance, and make quite impact on people's life. So I started looking to solve that problem for any company I would do. I wasn't looking to build a global employment platform. And the more I dig into it, the more I realized that if you use software to make hiring somebody on the other side of the world as easy, if not better, than hiring locally, you can change the world. You can enable companies to hire talent anywhere, and you can enable people to have the world as their oyster when they are looking for job opportunities. So I got obsessed.
Coming to the branding there as well. Is that where the oyster name come from, that phrase?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Fantastic. Because it actually works well for the employers, because now the world is their oyster when they're about to look for talent. They don't have to look for talent only in the cities that have offices in. And secondly, it's great for the talent around the world, because you don't have to be restricted to your own country boundaries for looking for a job. You can have the world as your oyster. And it's also an animal, and it's like more organic name, and we thought the brand would talk more to our customers, the HR professionals that we work with every day, and helping them to think about they usually know how to hire very well in one country, and how they can hire in 180 countries without the need to really understand how payroll work in France, or how termination works in Nigeria.
Well, I mean, the problem you are solving, or Oyster solving, is so fundamental to such a significant barrier previously for companies that were locked into a certain geographical location because of the ignorance of things like compliance and payroll. And, forget about the sourcing and attraction side. Like, if you had the person, you would not be able to handle paying this person. You would not know how to do it. So Oyster is really, I think, unlocking. It's the reason why it's such a hugely valuable business, right? It's like, oh my goodness, if somebody actually gets this right and creates a turnkey solution for an employer to be able to post a job and hire that person from anywhere, that makes such a huge difference.
Why this is so valuable for the world, and for the market, is because we are taking a local lawyer, a local accountant, a local HRBP, a local tax person, and we're softwarizing all of these four functions with an elegant platform that really talks the language of an HR person sitting in HQ, and simplify that whole jargon for them. That's why it's a heavy lift, really, to solve. You have Carta that solved the lawyer and a spreadsheet with Captable. You have companies like Intuit, TurboTax, that solved for taxes. They took 500 books of US tax law and turned it into an application that is user friendly. So we're solving lawyer, HRBP, an accountant, and payroll in one country with one platform.
You know what would be very interesting data for your, maybe your team could produce this at some point, is if it's possible to track like how distributed a company becomes before and after like using Oyster. When they first hire Oyster, what's the distribution of their employee base? And then a year later, like, where is that distribution? 2 years later, where is that distribution? You would imagine it should just continually distribute, right?
It's massive. It's massive. Our customer expanded 6 times in 12 months. We have customers that have half of their workforce on Oyster. We have customers that one customer is hiring in 35 different countries. So we see that distribution of hiring becoming a secret weapon for companies as they go and try to attract the best talent out there.
What's another thing that's interesting is that previously when you're looking at this type of international hiring or hiring from a global talent pool, typically you'd need to have like a strategy or a plan around it, right? You're going to say, right, I'm going to definitely plan to hire this engineering team in Buenos Aires. I need to have this and this involved before I even think about it. But now it's like, okay, just stick the job out there and see who the best people are. And you don't have to do that like forensic detail in advance of actually identifying and speaking to the people. So I think this unlocks the door for so many businesses out there. Tony, we have to talk about COVID-19 because it's obviously a mega accelerant for your business. Now, you started Oyster before then, but kind of like very close to when the first breakout was happening.
Yeah,
Did you have an inclination at the time to think, okay, this timing is perfect, or was COVID just like something like very small in your mind when you started the journey here?
So we started the January 2020, the business, and the moment we raised our first seed round, COVID hit. And it took us a few months to realize, 3 months, that, oh my God, we have to accelerate everything. We have to get ready in big time. So we built an employment infrastructure in 180 countries. We built the best software platform that makes global hiring possible and delightful. And we built an amazing team that is today nearly 400 people distributed in 70 countries in the last, mostly in the last 12 months. What the pandemic changed, it accelerated the remote work trend. It could have taken another 10 years to get to where we are today. It just kind of contracted time and pushed smaller organizations to start having a global talent acquisition strategy. Before, who can hire at that scale? It used to be enterprise customer because they have the entities and the lawyers and the accountant, and they have all these service providers that can help them. SMBs, smaller organizations and startups didn't have that luxury. Now it has changed. When you give them a platform like Oyster, that we're coining the autopilot of global employment, because they can scale super rapidly and hire anyone anywhere with a few clicks. Last year, 6 hours was a record between submitting a contract to the employee ready to go and work for a company on our platform. This year, I expect it to be less than an hour.
That's a great number to look at, man. I mean, number to look at.
I mean, and you have to understand, you know, unlike the US where employment is at will, other countries, it's much more complicated. I mean, like there's no way like in a talent acquisition person sitting in HQ, they don't need anymore to really go and dig into what is termination policy look like in Morocco, you know, like they don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a huge barrier prior to software solutions like this. It's not that it's impossible to figure out. It's just that extra admin load for someone who's already up to capacity. They're not going to go there. So yeah. They've always almost like unfairly neglected talent from different parts of the world because they just didn't want the prospect of having to deal with additional admin.
When you remove that, right? So you have, let me give you some data. There's 1.5 billion knowledge worker coming into the workforce in the next 10 years, mostly in emerging economies. All they need is a computer and a laptop and a calm place to be able to be effective. What an amazing opportunity for the world to enable these people to be successful, to change the way they organizations have to change the way they operate so they become more effective and more successful at being distributed, at making their distributed workforce successful. And that 1.5 billion knowledge worker is a massive opportunity. You have Brian Kaplan, who is the economist at George Mason University. He wrote a book called Open Borders. He argues in his book that if you remove the concept of labor, of barriers, of borders in front of labor mobility, and you have this free flowing of labor across the world, you can triple the world GDP. You can triple the world GDP. So this is not a business opportunity. You know, this is a societal and economical and environmental opportunity, because all these people that don't have to commute anymore, and they can be spread instead of being crammed in cities. You know, we've been pouring 4 times the size of New York City in urban areas in concrete in the world today every year. And these people, you know, nobody, like, I can imagine some people wants to be in the city for the lifestyle. I get that. But most people don't have a choice.
I think most people who kind of end up in cities, and you know, anybody who's living in a big city now would probably agree, you probably weren't born in that city. You know, how many of the 10 million people in New York were born in New York? Probably less than 50%. How many people in London were born in London? Yeah. Probably less than 10%. So people move to the big city because they have to for economic opportunity.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is, we can remove that simply by accelerating remote work and pushing the job to where the person wants to be. I mean, it doesn't have to be geographically constrained.
I mean, look at where, you know, I used to live in London and the Bay Area for 15 years.
I know you're in Cyprus, Tony, and having a bit of
fun. Let me show you.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the most beautiful sunset in the world. It's here. I live in a small village. It's a fisherman village. I don't need anything more. I can lead a multi-billion dollar company from here.
That's, you know what, let's talk about this, because a lot of leaders in particular, like in the dynamic or the conversation we're having outside of, let's say, the Oyster world, right? Because you've already set your business up in this fashion. So I think you've hired individuals that are already of that mindset. But the conversations we're having with companies that are, let's say, are more mature, they've been around longer, they've got a lot more legacy. There seems to be an executive versus employee contest as to, you know, where is the location? Have you noticed this, where employees are saying, you know what, remote everywhere?
CEOs, yeah.
Right. Goldman Sachs saying, get back in the office. All these retailers, Asda and all this stuff saying, thank God, lockdown's over. Get down it, get back to the office. And it's like, okay, clearly the bosses, all bosses, feel that they cannot run a business this way. Now, you're saying you can. What lessons have you learned running a remote-only business? Because I don't think Nexmo was remote-only, right? So this must be the first time for you also, Tony. So what did you learn, and what are the things that are possible, and how can you get this wrong?
Yeah. So what I've learned is that it can be more efficient, and also better well-being for the employees if done right. It's a win-win for the business and for the employees. But to get there are challenges. So there are challenges in terms of designing a way of communication and collaboration that is inclusive, that can make everybody successful no matter what they are. That's obviously using a lot the asynchronous way of communication and collaboration. At Oyster, we are innovating in that space, and we're open sourcing a lot of our way of operating with the world. The secondly is, it's harder to actually build trust. It's harder to build trust because trust is a very there is some emotional component to trust, and there is a physical body language presence that it's really hard to capture. So we have to double down on trust in distributed organization. We have to bake it into the way we operate as and that's why one of our values at Oyster is build trust. And we have various ways of building trust. We make it.
I was going to say, how do you do that, Tony? Like, what are the techniques to build trust in a remote only environment?
So I think first you need to have a commitment of everybody in the leadership team on psychological safety. How can we be the safest place to be in terms of being, you know, we don't want to create an environment where people are scared to be here. Secondly, for me, building trust is also about, I call it absolute commitment to the success of the people. So you have to kind of manage your ego as a leader and make sure that there's nothing in the way between you and being absolutely committed to people's success. Third is for me is also building that rapport, that social connection that doesn't, it's hard to build in distributed work. So for instance, in part of my team, I have, when I do my one-to-one with them, we always start with checking in. We always start with checking in on how they're doing in their life, in their work. And that has a, that requires that the reporting happen in advance. Like I don't have to check out the result of what you're doing. I'm checking on you as an individual, as a human. So we have this always reporting happen in advance. It's asynchronous. So I block like a day, half a day, a couple of hours in a week where I kind of post through the Loom videos and every person in my team, and then I'm ready to be present, fully present for them in the meeting. Thirdly, and I've been reflecting on that in my personal journey as a CEO is what is kind of, it's really addressing what's in the way of trust. And what's in the way of trust is usually for me is this negative emotion that we hold in our heart towards others and we are completely unconscious. Think about anger, resentment. And in order to manage that, these emotions, you have to start by forgiving everybody around you about all these emotions that are in you, because actually most of the time it's just an internal illusion. You generated these emotions and they are in the way. They're in the way of being close to other and build trust. And that's one of the kind of latest technique that I'm using with my team to really be fully present and fully committed to them as humans.
You've made some really interesting points, Tony, and I want to dive into some of these because I think they're each of them are so interesting to be aware of. The second point in particular immediately struck me. I'll introduce it now before I forget it. But you're saying, hey, listen, one of the ways to do this is to invest time in the person. So the one-to-one relationship, one-to-one meeting should be a meeting between one and one persons. And you can do that by having the report delivered in advance through Loom video. Yes. And I just wonder how many people actually do that. I mean, if you're a manager and you're dealing with a one-to-one, are you actually collecting the information asynchronously via Zoom and then just having a chat with your person? Or are you trying to do them both at the same time? Because they may be two different activities, right? And those two things can be separated. Where did you come up with that idea, Tony? Because I think that's quite an interesting innovation.
Yeah, I mean, our team is the best team in the world in terms of building distributed best practices. And our chief people officer has been 20 years building distributed teams, a thought leader in the space. So we're bringing innovation. Our goal is to be the gold standard of distributed work. So because we have to prove to the world that
right, you can eat your own dog food. Yeah, totally.
You can be a hyper growth tech company, have high level of well-being and belonging in the company, while being distributed in 70 countries. We have to push the boundaries of what's possible here to be able to invent a new way of working, and that's why you need discipline. So part of the, you know, asynchronous work is that not only you want to have the tools, but you want to have the rules and kind of enforce them from the top, obviously by staying open for innovation and improvement. Like I have my chief of staff that created a process for my team that enables them to update, provide their Loom video and their asynchronous update on Monday, before Monday evening cutoff date. Tuesday morning, I wake up, I listen to all these videos. Tuesday afternoon, we have an exec team meeting. And then after that, I have all my one-to-ones in the week. And it's always, we spend 10 to 20 minutes in the hour. It's really about checking in on the person. I call them heartbeat meetings because I already know what the results, and I need to know your challenges. And we've already been talking about them maybe for a couple of days on asynchronously. And so I am fully present for my teammates in that meeting.
And in the value of that is that it just, as you say, it's an accelerant on trust building, because if there was an ulterior agenda to that meeting, oh crap, Tony's gonna, you know, put some pressure on me or whatever. If it was that kind of sense, of course, there's not going to be trust. You have to get rid of that. It has to be completely eliminated. And it's a meeting between two people that are pointing in the same direction, they're working together in a business. I think that's a really remarkable innovation, Tony. So well done on that. There should be a book coming out. Is there some sort of material that, you know, people should be reading? I think this is really, really... again, it's like, it's hard for me to say. It's potentially profound stuff, you know.
Go ahead. I'm, you know, it's like it's really exciting to be. Like for me, it's exciting to do both my job as a CEO of a hyper growth tech company, but at the same time, change what it means to be the CEO of a hyper growth tech company, right? Can you really succeed? Both your life and your business, and this is the opportunity to show you, yes, you can. You don't have to burn out. You don't have to. But look, I mean, like I'm maybe portraying a too rosy picture here. It's still hard, and it's by phase. Like at the moment, we there's a lot of things going on. So I'm working really hard and long hours and. I'm not very happy with the way I'm taking care of myself and being present to my family, but I know that in 3 weeks it's going to be a better cycle.
Yeah. And it is like not to, as you say, it's important that we don't sort of have a naively optimistic view as to how it is, but I think it's so important to hear the message that you're kind of, the agenda behind the business is bigger than just the business. It's also about the organization around that. The business is the people. So how is that human organization also going to thrive and go forward? Let's talk about sort of people who, some people are not going to be able to vibe with this, Tony. When you hire people and you bring people at scale, you're growing super fast. Obviously, you want to keep the bar very, very high, but inevitably, you're going to be hiring a few people that don't chime with the way in which it works. How early do you get to know that? And what do you do to, I mean, do you try and fix it or do you make an early decision? You know what, this person's like working mode, preferred working mode isn't correct for us. We better part ways.
Mm. Yeah, you have to reduce that risk to the very, very minimum in the recruitment process. And for us, we have in my team, executive team, and you know, director and above level, we have a very stringent recruitment process where it involves case studies where the candidate need to present to a number of teammates a problem and walk us through it, and that enable us to really understand the person, how they think, how they behave, and that enabled us to reduce completely the risk of fitting. But you know, it's also about making it much larger. You know, like you don't want to have a culture that is too discriminating. You know, you want to have a very more universal culture to a certain extent, so you can actually enable people from you know, various behavioral patterns to fit, you know, and that's what's also in distributed organization, is that you're not in the office, right? You're interacting mostly with your people asynchronously. So as long as you can take this asynchronous way of working and codify it in the way they in how people should behave, how they should conduct meetings, how they should make decisions, how they should take care of themselves, then you start creating a meta culture of work that is independent of the personal preferences or behavioral patterns outside of work. We start having a more homogeneous way of behaving at work that is designed specifically to make people successful and highly collaborative, right?
What about the argument that there's some people that can't work very well asynchronously, but they're not aware of this? So in other words, I remember having a really interesting, this is pre-COVID, right? But I had a revelation pre-COVID when I was speaking to a bunch of remote first companies then. So I truly respect how they were thinking, because they made a strategic decision to be remote, as you guys did, but they made it before everyone was pressured to do it. One of the things that really struck me when I was speaking, I forget the name of the CEO, but he mentioned to me, look, we need to hire people that understand what remote is. A lot of people that had worked on premise all their lives, they actually don't understand that it's a fundamental shift in the way in which you communicate. It's written over spoken. It's asynchronous versus synchronous. And they found that you couldn't necessarily interview against that because everyone would be, you know, reporting that they would be happy with this approach. But then when it came down to working, they would still try and shift into synchronicity. And that was that would be forcing other people, pulling other people into a format that wouldn't suit them. And they actually made a rule. Actually, we're not going to hire anybody that hasn't previously worked remote before because they wanted to hire only individuals that had pre-configured their lives around the concept of remote. Now, I thought that then it was quite a remarkable position, maybe an extreme position. But for a small company at the time, I thought that was quite smart because it reduced their risk of hiring the wrong person, presumably. But for a big company, going into a big company like you guys are, presumably that's not a choice you can make. Like, you have to be hiring people that may not have worked in absolutely as remote as you have before. How do you make sure that they're able to operate in this environment?
You know, I'd love to have a conversation with the CEO because I want to convince him or her to change their mind. Because I believe in brain elasticity. The change that's happening now from in office to distributed is not very dissimilar from the change we did from the factory era to the office era. And look, we've adapted as a species. So if you're today, if you're coming into the workforce today, you're going to be coming with no preconceived way of what should work be, and therefore, as a very adaptable species, we're going to adapt to a new way of working, and it's going to be the way of working. So it's a transitional phase, and also I want to add that it doesn't like this new way of working had to be taught. To that you have right. to
so it's not innate show, yet it's learned yet
but the same as going to the factory, you know, people before when they were farmers and went to the factory, it wasn't, you know, they have to learn it. The same thing when they went from the factory to the office, they have to learn it. So now we need to teach people what does it mean to move from the office to work from anywhere. And that's why Oyster, we have the Oyster Academy, which is a program designed for both HR professional to deliver internal training about remote work, but also individuals. If you want to become a better remote worker, you go through the Oyster Academy, and we teach you how to improve your remote work skills, how to build trust, how to communicate, how to not feel isolated, how to build a social rapport. So it's a new way of working, and it's going to take a bit of neural adjustment. But it's, yeah. I believe in the potential of humans to tap into that elasticity that is with us, you know, like we have to believe that we all have amazing brains that are capable of learning new things.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we understand enough, I think, about neuroscience that plasticity is something that we all have, but it needs to be practiced. In other words, it's possible to become more rigid over time. As we all know, as we all grow older, inevitably our plasticity becomes a little bit more rigid, but we have to break it. We have to always like constantly heat it up to make sure we're learning new things. And I think that's a human life skill that we should all really try and implement. But sometimes, of course, we find ourselves not able to do that for whatever reason. You talked about the building of trust difficult in a remote setting. I think that is true. You've developed techniques to improve this. There is an argument to say, look, this is the reason why Zuckerberg has gone so hard on the metaverse, because I think he is aware that yes, remote is going to be difficult, and maybe a bridge towards that is some sort of experience where it is certainly a digital experience, but it still generates that ambient information that you don't get through either writing or through textual communication, basically. What's your take on metaverse? What's your take on AR, VR? Have you guys experimented with it in any way in a working context?
Yeah, we have looked at it, and definitely there are a lot of innovation that are happening in our area. Many of them is about to recreate the office virtually, the office experience virtually. I think that's a valid path, and there are certain way of working. There are ways of working that requires to have this office proximity type of interaction. You know, think about like brainstorming session or solving highly complex problems in real time. You know, I think this is require that. But the majority of the the work we do as knowledge workers is actually doesn't require necessarily to be in the same place. And so I think that there are the parallel tracks. You know, there are these kind of two ways of working and virtually and in a distributed way. And I think they're not going to be a right or wrong answer. I think it's going to depend on the use case. Because, you know, it's really, if you really want to have, if you're an engineer in Ghana, you know, maybe you don't have access to that technology yet, right? Right. So why do you want to create these technological barriers? Now the work can be done virtually with a laptop and interconnection, and that's it. Why do you want to wait till this technology become accessible and mature? And secondly, I think there's we have to change what work is. You know, work was this thing that we would commute to, and it was a place. Now it's not a place anymore. It's something you do, and that give us like that give us some level of freedom in our life, which is we can work from anywhere. We can adjust our life based on our life requirement. You know, I was picking up my daughter from school an hour ago. If I was in the office, I couldn't do that, right? The other day, my neighbor in France, in the middle of the winter, he had his chimney broken, and he called me at 2 p.m. in the afternoon to bring him to the shop and help him fix that. So I wouldn't have been able to be so engaged with my local community if I was like 40 miles away in an office. So there's a new vision for work.
I just want to say that's a really remarkable image. You know, when you're a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar business trying to fix a chimney from a neighbor. That's a great image to hold on. But I think it does have a very important message, which is the previous division the hard division we had between life and work. You know, we work-life balance and all this type of stuff. That has disappeared to a large degree with regards to the shift to remote. That can be a good or bad thing. I know a lot of people think, oh, it's very intrusive. But on the other side, if you have control of the intrusion, like in other words, you can actually have the agency to shut the door if you want, or you can let it in if you want. Suddenly, all the stresses disappear a little bit. Mm. And as an additional sort of factor, there's all those little admin tasks of life that previously we were not able to perform. We had to offshore that or outsource that to somebody else, or we had to load it up onto the weekend. Remember the weekend shop, right? I mean, that exists purely because you don't have the time. You know, by the time you get back from your 9 to 5, the shops are closed already. You have to do it on Saturday or Sunday. So you have this awful experience on the weekend.
Or going to the doctor, you know.
Obvious stuff like that. Like, it's critically important stuff like this, actually. We should get healthier because we're going to see the doctor more, hopefully. So yeah, I think the argument from a theoretical point of view is broadly one. There's still... I think important counter arguments that I'm sure will that have validity as well. But we'll explore them as we go. But there's no question that the direction of travel is clear. And Oyster is certainly on the right path. Talking about Oyster, talking about the software product, I think most people know what the company does. It's basically a turnkey solution for businesses that want to hire anywhere. You know, take care of the HR back office, take care of the payroll, take care of the legal side, boom, boom, boom. What else is down the product roadmap for existing Oyster customers 2022? What can they expect? They've already got a license with you guys. It's great. What are the new things that are going to happen to them this year, do you think?
Yeah, so this year we're moving into completely automating that employment experience. We spent the last couple of years building the infrastructure and automating partially the experience. Now we're moving to 100% automation. We call it this autopilot of global employment to a degree where we can guide the HR person to design their own employment package and contract and benefits completely self-serve. Obviously, you say, well, you know, that's great, but you know, if you do it in one country, that's easy. But if you want to do it in 180 countries, it's a pretty, pretty complex challenge that the team is solving. And secondly, is really the taking the employee experience to the next level, because our customers, they are attracting talent, and the power have shifted from employers to employees. So it's really important for our customer to be enabled by Oyster to be an attractive employer for an ever more distributed workforce. Like why a developer in India shouldn't have access to the best health insurance that their employer can provide them with, right? Just giving an example. Or why a sales executive in Argentina cannot have access to equity for the company cannot offer them equity because they are in Argentina. No, that shouldn't be the case. So we're moving extremely fast in designing that best in class employee experience because not because you are in country X that you should have a different treatment than the rest of the employees. And that's part of who we are as a mission-driven company, first and foremost, making the oyster, the world is the oyster of talent around the world. And this is what drives, and also when you think about it, what drives our roadmap is also the complex cross-border employment when it comes to tax, regulation, payroll, HR advice and market insights. So all of that, we're building that data container from all these fragmented countries and layering in smart applications on top to be able to exploit these data and open them to the world.
Yeah, fantastic. And again, the advantage of operating Oyster as a distributed business is that you are your own test case in many cases, aren't you? So, you know, it's a clear competitive disadvantage if you didn't do this. You know, imagine you're trying to pilot Oyster in one HQ, 700 people all working together. You will unintentionally develop processes that are not Oyster product processes.
Yeah.
And it will make you worse product developers as a result of this.
This is not very dissimilar to John Deere, the tractor company. John Deere won the tractor category, not because they invented tractors, but because they taught farmer how to farm better. So for us, part of our mission is how can, through being Oyster, to share with the world how do they evolve successfully to a more distributed world of work.
A question about the sort of diversification of working contracts, Tony. We talked about sort of obviously every country has a different legislative environment, but also every country has different categories of worker. They have different ways to deal with all of this. And one of the things that I think HR have always wanted to do but were frightened to do was to be able to access different types of worker, because sometimes wouldn't it be great if we had more flexibility in the workforce? But again, they were terrified of, oh my goodness, this additional admin load of having to deal with all these freelancers or whatever they might be. Is Oyster in that game? Are you producing any kind of services that helps that HR person handle a diversification of employment type?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a massive amount of diversity that comes with hiring globally. As I said, some of our customers have employees in 40 countries. And so what an amazing place to be when you have people from 40 countries working together to deliver something. But the other area is the diversity of law of regulation that we abstract. The HR leader to really need to understand we our platform talks HR friendly language, even though their workforce is distributed among many countries, so essentially you think about it as Oyster would be your gateway to employ people anywhere, even though you have one country where you have your HQ.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I actually answered your question, Hong. Can you repeat the question?
I think you answered the question, but probably not the idea of like diversity within a country. So in other words, regional diversity, we understand.
I see. Okay, got it. So it's actually, yes. So our platform is focused on knowledge workers. So we allow companies to attract and retain top knowledge workers. So we don't go into other type of work. Like if you're in the healthcare industry or the service industry that simplifies a lot. Like the countries have codification of their workers, and if you're knowledge workers, that's like a category, everybody knows what it is. Like in France, they call them cadre. these type of population that are knowledge worker versus the rest of the workforce. So we're really focused on knowledge worker, and that limits to a certain degree, not everything. I mean, it's still massively complex, but at least it narrows down a bit of the universe of compliance and regulation that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. It's good again to have a focus in terms of who the core segment is and who the who are the people that get processed in the system, right? Because very difficult to swallow the entire ocean there. Tony, a couple of questions for you as an experienced entrepreneur. You've kind of done some amazing things in your career. There may be people listening to this that might be taking their first step towards being an entrepreneur and, you know, thinking, hey, maybe one of these days I could run, you know, $1 billion business. What kind of advice would you give that person, having sort of kind of gone through the pipe a little bit and then got the scars on your back? Like, what should entrepreneurs be aware of before they take that first step? Advice for those folks.
Yeah, I think the number one advice is align what you do with what you believe in, because whatever you do as an entrepreneur is going to be a roller coaster. There's no quarter that passes that I don't think about quitting my job, and I can't quit, right? So essentially, it's a difficult, challenging role. I would say I'm not saying it's more challenging than other roles, but we have to acknowledge that it is hard. And some when as an entrepreneur, you're dedicating a lot of your attention to your business, and therefore it can be emotionally draining. So the first thing is aligning what you believe in with what you do enables you to really be clear about why you're doing what you're doing, and gets you to overcome some of these low points in the journey.
I was just about to step in. I think with that alignment, it gives you the resilience to go through the inevitable troughs, right? Because if you're it's one of the things that allows you to just keep going. A lot of success. Who is it that said, like, I forget who it was, like 95% of success is just like constantly showing up and constantly being there. And I think, okay, maybe that's an exaggeration, but there's this kernel of truth there, because you have to keep doing it in order to build almost the muscle memory, in order to kind of create these another sense of trust, because the customers need to trust that you're always going to be there, your partners, your workforce always got to trust you got to be there, and you can't be that way of mercurial. So there is, like, to get that resilience isn't just being a tough guy, it is understanding and aligning your core intrinsic value with this project you're doing, and then that makes you really, really able to persevere. So really significant point, Tony.
The other tip here, Hong, is to realize that you cannot do this on your own, and you need to build a team that through you they can succeed. So you want to actually align your personal interests with your team's interests, or at least manage your personal interests a bit on the side, so that you can be really committed, absolutely committed to these people's success. And that means to be able to do so, you want to be less attached to the end result. So you want to acknowledge that you might succeed, you might fail. This is high risk opportunities. But if you attach too much to the outcome, then that will become in the way of you becoming a leader for your team, right? So you want to manage that carefully, so you don't bring in all the negative stuff that we know some CEOs might bring into an organization. They get like blinded by we have to get to this point. We have to succeed. We have to. You know, let's do everything. Let's burn the competition. Let's burn $100 million, and let's work over the weekend. Let's just, you know, I don't buy that.
Yeah,
I think that's in the way.
I think with that end goal, it's really tough balancing out mentally, isn't it? Because of course you have the dream, and of course you have the confidence you will get there, and you know you need to apply the effort. But having established all of those things in your own mind, you need to then compartmentalize that and say, understand it's also a very difficult journey, and there's any number of reasons why it will not end up in that location. And in fact, if you look at some of the most amazing tech businesses or any kind of business that has emerged Most of them started off trying to do something different before they failed, you could say, and then they rediscovered a new path, and from that failure they built on and went forward. So it is perfectly possible, but I think so important, again, you don't want to crush yourself mentally to try and do this, and at the same time don't compromise your morality either. I was just thinking when you're talking about like CEO misbehavior, I was immediately thinking of like Theranos, for instance, and that famous example, criminality goes in and all this type of stuff happens.
I'm talking about much less serious issues like this. I mean, there are very, very much, if you take a big percentage of successful CEOs today and leaders in the world, it wasn't without making some sort of damage somewhere, emotional. Yeah. Like who doesn't like, we all see this image of a CEO as a fearful, powerful person that can fire people and assess performance, and is very, their mood might influence, like people are that's where, and I understand I was there in my previous company, right? I was there, first time entrepreneur, really attached to that result, outcome, and these things start to pop up, and yep. You're not aware of them. You think you're doing your job, but actually you're creating maybe not the healthiest, most safe environment for the team to thrive in.
Yeah, I hear you, Tony. That's very, very clear. And as you say, time's to come to reflect it. And the emergence of this is a totally different type of environment, totally different type of business, which may in fact have a much bigger footprint at the end of the day. So congratulations on pushing forward on that. Tony, we've got a question from a person that I just want to deal with real quick. Okay, this person wants to work in New Zealand. That's great. But we're going to go to Julia Popper Visiu, I think. Julia is saying, okay, what recommendations do you have for people who now don't work remotely, but want to transition to working fully remote? How do they practice the relevant skills, getting them ready to prepare for a distributed team? So let's imagine you're hiring somebody, you've hired them, in fact, but they've never worked remote. Can they go on a course? Like, what do they need to know in order to be very quick in performing well and thriving for a business like Oyster?
Yeah, so as a remote worker, there's two scenarios. Either you're working with a company that is adopting a remote work structure, or you're not, right? So if you are part of this company, I'm sure the company have all the relevant tools and training for you. Actually, our Oyster Academy is our internal training that we've open sourced and become used by anybody. And if you're not, if you're in a company is not fit for remote work, but you are a remote worker, there's still a lot of things you can do to adapt your behavior to the company so that you can increase your chances of performance. And there's requires a lot of dialogue that you need to have with the company, specifically around protecting your life when it comes to time zone and flexibility, and isolation is the hardest when you are a remote worker in a company that is not remote. Yeah. Right? Because everybody else is connecting and you're not. So then you have to be aware of that and adjust your social interactions so that you can be part of the team but not in the same place.
Yeah, I think you mentioned something there that's really important, because there's now many flavors of remote. There's companies, of course, fully remote, fully distributed. Other ones are kind of split in different ways. I think that's a really difficult one to kind of wrestle with, to be honest with you, when you have like, people that do meet in person and people that don't. It's like, that is that, how healthy is that? And then fully on premise, of course. So yeah, firstly, understand the context of the business that you're going in, maybe adjust the rhythm. And I think tempo and rhythm is something also that's important, right? So you understand like what is the rhythm of the company? When do they have a significant meeting? When is the regular things? What are the rituals? If you can understand what those types of things are, and you can kind of think, okay, this is the rhythm I need to go to, then you're more or less there. Okay, Tony, listen, we're running out of time, and I don't want to take any more of your weekend away from you. I can see the sun is just coming down, so I want to go out there and get some more sunshine, dive into the sea or something. But before I let you go, let me just ask a question. Like, what do you have planned for the rest of the day? I know it's like Friday is like a chill out zone or whatever, or things that you've got to decompress. What are the things you need to clear off your desk before the weekend starts?
Yeah, so I need to kind of make sure that my inbox is to a low anxiety level, and I have a dinner planned this evening out. So, and hopefully the weekend I have no meeting.
I love it. Well, Tony, enjoy your dinner. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I think we could totally have, you know, another couple of hours chat about this. This is fascinating stuff. I've rarely met the CEO who is as committed to company culture, genuinely committed as you are. So best of luck to you and everyone at Oyster. It's very exciting to see where you guys are. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you, Hung. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a good week.
Oh, I cut Tony off. Wasn't that amazing? I tell you what, I was so impressed by that conversation. And in fact, you know, it's got me just thinking about all those other techniques. Like, what are the techniques you can put in place to build trust in a remote only environment? That is truly, truly something we should think about. You know, we can't assume these things are built without design. We've got away with it, I think, you know, when we're all in office and turning up every day, we kind of, yeah, of course we trust them because, the person's there. But in a different world that we're looking forward to here, and I think Oyster as a business and as a product is probably pointing us clearly in the direction of that future, you know, we need to better understand how you know, communities are built in this way. Anyway, listen, everybody, I hope you've enjoyed that Founders Focus. It was a great show. I really thought it was fantastic. We're back next week, of course. If you like this kind of conversational chat, please follow the channel. We do these types of shows every week. We're fully loaded with Founders Focus talks, by the way. We've got loads of them coming up. I think next week we're with... I forget who we're with next week, actually. Maybe Pedro Oliveira, actually, talking about Talent Protocol, Web3, and stuff like that. We are back next Friday as well with How to Tell a Good Recruiter. So we know it's like super hard to hire recruiters these days. But if you do encounter a recruiter and you want to bring that person on board, how do you know they're any good? Do you still just look at the CV and think, okay, that person must be good because they worked at X? Is there a way in which we could tell that that person is a good recruiter for your business? That's what we'll be exploring. We've got Mark Dubel at GitLab joining us. We've got Farah Kanji from Founders Factory. And we've got, who else? We've got Katrina Hutchison O'Neill, who's been hiring recruiters like crazy. So we've got loads of interesting people to join us on panel to talk about that topic. Make sure you sign up for the episode and we'll see you then. Okay, I want to go out. I think there's some sunshine in London as well. So forget what Tony's doing. I'm going to get some rays.